So last time we were supposed to be covering according to the program. The first session was to be dealt with all the subjects that are related to the process of renunciation. We didn't get through halfway last time, so hopefully this time I will backtrack a little bit. In order to bring talk about the subject of bodhicitta, enlightened mind. Before anything else, before, ideally before even you walk into this room or any other room, a gompa or what we call gompa in the Tibetan, the shrine room, the monastery if you like, the place where the teaching is to be given, there are certain prerequisites on your side that you need to implement before you even listen to any teachings, even simplistic as they are here, given here. So whether it's His Holiness the Dalai Lama giving the teachings, or whether it's somebody as simplistic as myself giving the teachings, the principle is the same. Yeah, the principle is the same. So here, because we're going to be discussing the mind of enlightenment, bodhicitta, it's a Mahayana. We must develop a Mahayana motivation. So therefore, even in theory, just pretend that you've come here tonight just for the benefit of all sentient beings, that you're going to be listening to these teachings. And that even if you just remember one word, one passage, anything here, that you're going to use that knowledge to achieve enlightenment for all sentient beings, everyone that you know that is suffering, just like us. So we must have that prerequisite. With that motivation, every action we do in body, speech and mind becomes a Mahayana virtuous act. So if you're going to be giving food, you compliment somebody, it becomes a Mahayana act because you have set the tone of, in this case, the teaching. So it's a Mahayana teaching. Secondly, as last time, we have to, we shouldn't be preoccupied with the person in terms of appearance, because we're all bound by appearance. You should be listening to the words. And then when you listen to the words, you should be listening to the meaning of the words. Then when you listen to the meaning of the words, you shouldn't listen to the interpretive meaning, but the definitive meaning of those words. So again, your perceptions have to change here and say, well, you're not Tibetan, you're not a monk, why should I listen to you? Well, obviously you're not listening to the words. You're not listening to what I'm saying. So if you have the karma to be here, then at least for your sake, not for my sake, because I'm already a Buddhist, you know, for your sake, listen carefully. Listen to the meaning and listen to the definitive meaning. You know, listen to that thing that really, that you need to take home with you tonight. Then, the second aspect, which is even more important, is the three principles of the pot. So on our side, how should we behave when we're listening to any teachings? Again, when I say that, in your mind you should be thinking His Holiness the Dalai Lama and everybody else below that. And so the three principles of the pot is, it's like a cooking pot. Yeah, we shouldn't be, our mind should not be like a cooking pot that has no bottom. So whatever we put inside falls out. So in other words, when you listen, you retain what you've heard. Secondly, you shouldn't be a pot with a lid on top of it, so nothing can be put in. So in other words, we're not closed-minded about what's being said, simply because of my appearance. You don't know anything, Robert. What are you doing? As I said last time, don't look at the hair, listen to the words. Then, the most subtle point, which is do not be a cooking pot that is still greasy on the inside. It hasn't been cleaned. So whatever we put into that pot, it still tastes like garlic or whatever has been cooked before. So the equivalent of that is we come into this class or any other class with a biased mind. We come in, we say, oh well, you know, I know more than you. I know more than the Dalai Lama. I'm just coming here just to see if he knows what I know. So obviously, it's said in the scriptures that you can't teach the Dhamma to somebody that has pride. It's not possible. It's impossible to teach somebody with pride. It's spiritual matters, because they know more than you do. Inverted commas. So this is the most important motivations that we have. Now, or any of these subjects that are any of things that I've just mentioned, you can go away and meditate on them for 2 or 3 weeks, just right now, without even starting the subject. So the whole subject of bodhicitta, the whole subject of the Mahayana path, Mahayana, the great vehicle, as a lot of people misunderstand. And of course, this is all coming from the Tibetan point of view. You must keep that in mind. Other traditions have different interpretations. So what I say here, if you're coming from a different tradition, you have to obviously do a lot of calculations in your mind and convert a lot of things that I'm saying into your tradition. Or perhaps it doesn't even fit into your tradition. You must take that into consideration as well. So, as I mentioned last time, one of the unique characteristics of Tibetan Buddhism is that Tibetan Buddhism contains all of the Buddha's teachings, the Hinayana, the Mahayana, and within the Mahayana, the Vajrayana path, or the Tantric path. No other tradition has that. Certain aspects of in Japan, China, I think, they contain Tantric, some of the lower Tantric aspects, but they do not contain the yoga and the highest yoga tantra aspects. Highest yoga tantra? Things like Kalachakra, which we're all familiar with His Holiness the Dalai Lama giving the teachings. That is a highest yoga tantric practice. But that is within the Mahayana tradition. So, what does it mean to be a Mahayana practitioner? What does it mean to be a Mahayana practitioner? Within the Tibetan tradition, Jetsun Karpa, who is the founder of the Gelugpa tradition, which His Holiness the Dalai Lama is a member of, the Gelugpa tradition. He is not the leader of the Gelugpa tradition. Gandam Tripa is the leader of the Gelugpa tradition. Jetsun Karpa says that the definition, or a Mahayana practitioner, is defined as someone, a person, in this case, a person. It doesn't, scripturally, a bodhisattva does not have to be a person, believe it or not. A naga, for example, can be a bodhisattva. A bodhisattva could be even, there is a famous case back in the late 60s, early 70s, in the Gap. Is the Gap in the South Head or the North Head here? South Head. Does anybody know? No. South, yeah, thank you. Back in the early 70s or late 60s, there was a, Google it if you like, there was a famous Alsatian who could tell, and the Gap is renowned for people committing suicide. This Alsatian could tell whether somebody was committing suicide or whether they were there just taking pictures, being a spectator. You know, and nobody trained this dog. It did it by its own volition. So this dog was by itself rescuing people's lives. Technically, that's a bodhisattva. Now, for a lot of people, that's a bit of a mind twist. How can an animal be a bodhisattva? But from Buddha's point of view, form is irrelevant. It's the mind, the consciousness, that is the most important thing. So that's why you will hear things like, well, you know, when you're on a bus, there could be a Buddhist sitting beside you. You don't know about it. Because you don't know about it because you can't read somebody's mind. You're too preoccupied with the appearance, you know. So we're looking at mind. That's why it's important in this case, as I said earlier, to pay attention to the words. So even though in this case I'm not a monk or a Buddhist or a Tibetan, beg your pardon, it doesn't mean that it disqualifies me from helping in some minuscule way. But if you don't give me the chance to do that, then that nullifies everything. And we all miss out in some way. Me in terms of helping you, and you in terms of, well, I think the Dalai Lama is my teacher, so off you go to the Dalai Lama. But of course, as I mentioned last time, we don't have the karma to have the Dalai Lama as our personal teacher, to be on tap when we have crisis, or to give the in detailed teachings and commentaries. Very, very few people would have that such karma to have an enlightened being like that as their personal tutor. So, to be a Mahayana practitioner, we must have bodhisattva motivation, which is, I wish to achieve enlightenment, perfect enlightenment, for the benefit of all sentient beings, without discrimination. High or low. Whether you like me or you hate me is irrelevant. That's your karma, you know. So a bodhisattva for all sentient beings, no discrimination. Total 100% pure equanimity. Now, that in itself is an incredible thing to even just begin to kind of contemplate equanimity. Prior to that, prior to the subject of equanimity, it's not really recommended in the scriptures, but from my personal experience, before we even get to the subject of bodhicitta and the sevenfold cause and effect, which is one of the ways of generating the enlightened mind. The other one is through the process of exchanging oneself with others, which we will not be talking about here tonight, simply because it's too profound. Secondly, it requires a very subtle and agile mind. No disrespect. But if you're new to Buddhism, if you get the wrong message, you're going to think, oh yeah, I can do this. And people have become sick. People have abandoned the Dharma because they've misunderstood that particular point, because they thought they are capable of doing these things. When they were given those teachings, they totally got it wrong. They really, really got it wrong. They physically became sick because they abused the practice. So we're not going to be doing that. So we're going to be doing it simple, and hopefully we'll be able to go through all the points. So prior to all that, there is the subject of rejoicing. And the Buddha mentions in the Perfection of Wisdom in 8,000 shlokas the benefits of rejoicing. Now it seems like again, keeping in mind that we're working psychologically first, then spiritually second. Rejoicing seems like a very deceptively simple concept, and which simply is, you're feeling happy, sincerely happy, from the bottom of your heart, of somebody's good fortune, you know. Oh, they got married. It's not going to last. Excuse me? Excuse me? What did you say? You know, it's not going to last. What happened to rejoicing? Why are you talking like that? So, somebody obviously doesn't understand the law of cause and effect. Even if you pretend, don't verbalize it. Don't say the marriage isn't going to last or whatever, it's not going to work out, the relationship. Don't say it. Don't put it into the wind. You know, it's like the rabbi said, you know, it's like, you know, if you break a pillow in half and all the feathers fly out, you know. Can you put all the feathers back? How long is it going to take you to gather all those feathers and put them back into the pillow? You know. So don't say a negative thing, because it's just going to fly out and you can never be able to bring it back. Yeah. So even if you just pretend, yeah, good on you, woohoo, hope it lasts for 50 years, 100 years, whatever it is. Even just pretending that we're happy for someone has dramatic consequences for this self-grasping I, what colloquially we call ego, but the ego is still a byproduct of a self-cherishing mind. This is where Jung got it wrong. So, rejoicing, simply from the bottom of your heart, looking and seeing, you know, what, fantastic, that's wonderful, you got that job. You got the job before me, you're making more money than I am. You got the resources to go on holiday to Paris every year if you want. What? So rejoicing is an antidote to jealousy. Unless, dare I say, we're addicted to jealousy. And of course we are, because everyone you know is jealous. So therefore, through habit, force of habit, through social interaction, we have to talk and speak like them. Otherwise, if we don't, we're not part of that group. Hence, peer group pressure. So our peers dictate our psychological state. Now, from somebody which we will discuss a little bit, but we didn't discuss last time, somebody who is trying to find a way out of suffering, the last thing you want to do is hang around people who are propagating suffering and encouraging you to suffer even more. So now you're beginning to see there's a process of renunciation. I don't want this. I can see where this is heading. I can see how this is going to develop. So simply by rejoicing, and you say, that's fantastic, that's wonderful. Simply saying that, you stand out amongst a group of people who are cynical, sarcastic, you know. And people think, my goodness, you're so weird, it's so strange. So being compassionate, really, in the world that we live in, makes you stand out. And that begins to show you how much suffering there is out there, just by simply saying, fantastic, you got that. And people can say, ooh, that's a little bit too sweet for me. I can't handle such, you know, you're too whatever, you know, I need a little bit of anger, I need a little bit of jealousy, and that goes to show, again, how important it is to know our psychological state by saying, you're addicted to anger, you're addicted to negativity, you need that. So we know for a fact, psychologists know for a fact, that children who are brought up in abusive environments, either physically abusive, verbally abusive, angry, where domestic violence is all the norm, children like that who are taken out and put into foster care, where all of a sudden you're put into loving parents, hi, you okay? You got your own bed, everything's sweet, they're looking after you. You know, the foster parents are, you know, sincerely looking after you, asking you questions, what do you want to do? You want to come with me? You want to come to work? Whatever it is. It's too quiet. It's too tranquil for them. Because they've been brought up in such a violent environment, they actually have to create violence to feel comfortable, feel like they're in control. So they have to yell, scream. Where in a foster care where there is no yelling or screaming, where there is no discord, they actually have to create it. Why? Through habitual tendencies. This is how they've been brought up. They need that in order to feel in control. Now, if you think carefully, we, in a subtle way, fall in the same category as well. We're interacting with people who are jealous all the time, pride, anger, etc., etc. You remove yourself from that. You hang around with a bunch of monks or nuns. Everybody's polite, mindful, courteous. No reason to talk unless there's a reason to talk. No gossiping, malicious talk, slander. Boring. How boring is that? Why is it boring? Because you're used to being angry. You're used to being jealous. You're used to criticizing somebody. You're used to sexually harassing people. You're used to criticizing somebody so you feel better. It's a normal survival mechanism. By understanding that about ourselves, you can clearly see where you are. It's basically somebody's just turn on the light switch and you say, oh, so this is what it looked like. This is where I'm standing. This is where I kind of belong right now. This is your karma, this present situation. So change has to be voluntary. If it isn't voluntary, if you force yourself to be a Buddhist or anything like that, if you're forcing yourself that change before it's time, before you understand who you are, the ramifications could be quite drastic towards the end of your life, because it accumulates. Karma accumulates. And if you're forcing yourself to do something, you know as well as I do, it's not going to work out. Not for very long. You can't run away from yourself. You can't change your karma on a dime, as the Americans say. It can only be done over a long period of time. In other words, the karma that you're experiencing now, yes, it's like looking out the window of a car or something. You're going the wrong way. But you've got to realize, you've got to wait for that car to run out of petrol before you can work your way back. So as I mentioned last time, for those who are here, the karma we have here now is from a previous lifetime. We're on a bus and you have a ticket. that's brought you now here. That ticket is null and void right now. As soon as you walked into this room, that ticket is null and void. You now need to buy a new ticket to take you further down the road. So this lifetime, this is it. This is it. As soon as you were born, the karma that brought you here, propelled you into this life, it's gone. It's finished. Now, you have to, because you have a connection with the Dhamma, this is your only time, your only opportunity, this life, that you have with the Buddhist teachings. And to get that ticket, you need to put a little bit of effort into the Buddhist teachings and create the virtue and the merit and use this precious human rebirth to get onto that bus and to take you on to a better lifetime next time around. Hopefully, it'll be a one-way ticket in terms of enlightenment. But because this is Mahayana, there is no one-way ticket, it's a two-way ticket. You will be coming back in order to benefit other sentient beings. No problem. If you have the resources, the ability to come back, there's no problem. There is no such thing as suffering, you know, when it comes to the Mahayana path. Everything is converted to the path to enlightenment. So, before we can actually be of benefit to anyone, we have to be of benefit to ourselves. So continuing on from the first class, we were speaking about death and impermanence. A lot of people don't want to talk about that subject, especially in the West. Hence, you avoid the spiritual path. And the purpose of all religion, the purpose of all religion, you name it, the purpose of all religion is the preparation for death. It's not about sitting beautifully with strong back and all this kind of Hollywood Buddhism. It's got nothing to do with that. It's preparation for death. Because if you look carefully, you know, in the New Testament, the Quran, all the scriptures, of the Jewish scriptures, the Talmud, you know, the Hindu scriptures, etc., etc., it's always telling you, you know, behave properly, do this, do that, yeah? Because this is what's going to happen to you when you die. This is where you're going to go when you die, etc., etc. So it's the same thing with Buddhism. The kindness of all the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas is they have come back here to give us the teachings in order to prepare ourselves for death. That's it. That is what will determine true happiness, lasting happiness. What we have now is temporary. It's transitional. It won't last, because what comes together comes apart. What goes up must come down. What is born must die and perish. Because impermanence is subtle, transitional impermanence that we're not aware of because we're too preoccupied with the concerns of this life. Actually, all the concerns of this life are an anesthetic. They anesthetize us. So we're immune, insensitive to what's going on around us. We're too busy talking about other people and being preoccupied out there. Very few look internally. And of course, that's what a spiritual path is. It's looking within. And a lot of people can't do that, don't want to do that because they're afraid, depending on how you were brought up, because it's going to bring back bad memories. Fair enough. Fair enough. Nobody can force you to do something that you don't want to do. Nobody wants you to do something that you don't want to do. So that's why I keep saying we need to understand our psychological state first before we can begin to look deeper in. Yeah? So we don't have any place to hide. Once we begin to look internally, we don't have any place to hide. We have to be nakedly honest with ourselves and say, yes, I've done this, I've said that, and I have to confess that. I have to admit that. And it's only once we understand those kind of things, which is karma. And karma is the actual door to happiness. That's actually when we begin the change, the real change. Last time, for those of you who were here, we did the Chenrezig purification practice with the four opponent powers. Scripturally, and the reason why I keep harping on about scripturally and is in Buddhism, we say there are only three ways we can know something is valid. Valid cognition, we say. For those of you who want to study Dhammakirti specifically. There are only three ways we know something is valid in Buddhism. One is through scripture, two is through our senses, and three is through inference. There is no other way we can know something is valid or not. So, I can feel it, I can touch it, that's valid. My senses are not perfect, but I can still walk through a door. I can still recognize that there are people here. Yeah? Through inference, you know? The smoke over there, well, there must be a fire. I can infer something. Doesn't have to be a fire. Could be somebody doing donuts with their car, you know, burning rubber or something like that. But I'm still, through my knowledge, I can infer there's something. Scripture is through the Buddha's own enlightened mind and through the Buddha's teachings. When the Buddha says something, we can say, well, that's it. The Buddha said so, full stop. There's no argument there. That's the definitive meaning. Why do we say that? Well, the Buddha is omniscient. The Buddha is free from all delusions, from all suffering. The Buddha will never have to experience suffering ever again. For us, it's very difficult to comprehend to be free from jealousy, for example. I wouldn't know what that would feel like because it so permeates my body. Resentment. You know, anger. We do that how many times a day? It permeates us through every single pore of our body. So it's impossible for us at this point in time to comprehend what it would be like to be free from these kind of delusions. But yet the Buddha has done that through studying how the Buddha did it. Not just his life, but through the actual philosophical mechanisms that he went through, the actual practices. We can see that enlightenment is possible. Or is enlightenment just only possible for one person and the rest of us are just doomed to be worshippers? Again, this is something that we have to clearly see through our own experience, through our own understanding. Is enlightenment a practical possibility? Lama Tsongkhapa says it is. Lama Tsongkhapa shows us clearly how we can study, how we can, through reading, contemplation and meditation, we can actually become enlightened. It's a practical, doable possibility. It's not something just for monks and nuns. Some people think only monks and nuns can become enlightened. That's not true. If you think that, then you're pretty much closing the door to your own freedom and liberation. So, karma is the actual door to happiness by understanding that karma is certain, karma accumulates, it compounds, to use an accounting term. Gotcha. We cannot experience a karmic action we have not performed. Those karmic actions we have performed, we will definitely experience either in this life, the immediate next life, or some future lifetime. So, when we are talking about future lifetimes, we are talking about subtle consciousness. The soul, if you like. If you want to call it the soul, you can call it the soul. The mind, consciousness. It is this subtle consciousness that we possess that really is the doer of everything that we do. So this body we have, this is a karmic result of a consciousness and the previous karmic actions that we have done. Yeah? So one of the things that a lot of people really misunderstand in terms of reincarnation is that somehow, you know, this identity that I have of myself, etc., etc., will be somehow going on and on and on, and I'll forever be Robert. But the thing is, when we die, you will lose all identity of yourself. You won't be able to even bring your name with you. Everything, this life, basically, gets rubbed out. But the karmic actions we have performed, those things continue on. So that's why it's said in terms of contemplation on death, death is certain, the time of death is uncertain, And the only thing that can help us at the time of death, to make death a virtuous action, is our spiritual practice. That's the only thing we have that we can take with us. So spiritual practice means positive virtue, positive karma, actions that are conducive to acquiring a rebirth that will allow us to continue our spiritual education, if not enlightenment. So the minimum requirement that you would like is to be in contact with the Buddha's teachings sometime in some future lifetime. Guess what? That time is today. This is it. This is it. This life that you have is the result of all the prayers and aspirations that you've made in previous lifetimes. Very rare. Very, very rare. Because you're spending your time, effort, money just to come here, just to listen, just a little bit of the teachings. So that's part of buying that ticket that you need to go on down the road. So karma, going back to karma, fluctuating a little bit here in terms of subjects. But karma is action. A lot of people, if you remember that movie, The Godfather, I forget which one or two, where Michael Corleone is in the church and there's mass, there's a christening. And in the meantime, we see the scenes cut to his henchmen who are going around shooting other people that he's ordered to be assassinated. And yet, he looks like a God-loving man. He's there, family and in church, whatever, such a beautiful man. But yet there are people under his orders that are going around killing people. And yet, on his side, he's probably thinking, well, I haven't done anything. You know, I personally haven't killed anybody, etc., etc. But, and a lot of us think like that in terms of action. Just because you haven't done something physically doesn't mean you're not karmically responsible or involved in that action. So karma operates in body, speech, and mind. So if you want to generate a virtuous action, hey, I heard Bill got married. Woohoo! Yes! I hope it lasts forever. Rejoicing. Karmically speaking, you share now the good fortune of that person. Now, on the other hand, it's not going to last. Whoa! That's a negative karmic action, verbally. Don't say it. Don't say it. Even if you think it, don't say it, because you won't be able to bring back those words. Secondly, you say it to somebody else and they say, you know something, Robert, I think you're right. I don't think it will last. No, I didn't mean it. I didn't. You can't take it back. Now somebody else thinks that way too. You are now responsible for that. Karmically, that's it. Now the effort is going to be twice as hard to purify that action, which we'll talk about a little later on. So no mindfulness. Be careful what you say to who you say it to. When in doubt, leave it out. Yeah. So body, speech, and mind. So it's said, scripturally it's said, and I always like to say this to, I don't think there are any Sicilians in the audience, but I always like to say this to anybody who's Sicilian in terms of vendetta, back to the Godfather thing. Even though you don't personally kill somebody, or you don't personally order somebody to be hit, simply hating somebody, having a vendetta for somebody for 20, 30, 40, 50, 70 years, I wish they were dead. Scripturally speaking, you accumulate the karma of actually murdering somebody. Wow. Think about it, the hate that you have, you know. Oh, I heard whatever, I'd look, drop dead, you know. Just, I don't want to hear, I'm constantly putting the poison in the bucket. Constantly poisoning, it's a drip, 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 drip. And then you have a barrel, a swimming pool, a lake, an ocean. How in the world are you going to get rid of an ocean? You can't drink that. Nobody can. It's too late. It's fixed. It's huge. It's massive. Now you accumulate the karma of actually murdering somebody. The consequences of that? That brings us to the next subject, which is the thinking about the disadvantages of being reborn in a lower state of existence. What do you mean lower state of existence? We're going to be people forever, right? It doesn't work like that. Remember the consciousness? Consciousness takes on the form that is conducive to its karma. So any sentient being, a dog is a sentient being, anything with a mind is a sentient being. So we can, that's why there's this transition of adopting of different forms depending on our karmic situation. The karmic consequences of murdering somebody is to be reborn in a state of existence where you will have to experience similar or identical suffering that you have inflicted. So it's basically like a nightmare that just doesn't end. But yet, it's a nightmare with physical, genuine pain. And in fact, in the Perfection of Wisdom in 8,000 shlokas, the Buddha, when he was asked by the bodhisattvas to please describe the hell realms, the Buddha said, no, don't ask me to do this because you're going to throw up in blood. It's so horrific just to describe what's going on. So how do we know that the hell realms exist? Well, we know that that the Buddha said so. So that's scripturally, the Buddha said so. Why should I trust the Buddha in this case? I've never met the Buddha. Well, think of it this way. Think of somebody says to you, you know, they said, you know, I'm been to Paris. I've never been to Paris. But I've met somebody who's been to Paris. And they describe to me, Paris is this, you have to go to these places, there's this fantastic restaurant. What, just one restaurant in Paris? Come on, give me a break. You know, so, okay, so there's 3,000 good restaurants you need to go to in Paris, right? And so they're giving me a description from their own experience. Likewise, a Buddha. A Buddha has achieved enlightenment. A Buddha has direct perception of the lower states of existence. A Buddha can clearly read our minds. A Buddha can clearly see what's going to happen to us in 30 years' time. So therefore, we can infer that the Buddha has the knowledge and that the Buddha is telling us the truth. That if we do this and this and this, this is going to be the result. Yeah? So therefore, the hell realms do exist. Secondly, because everything is based on mental accumulation, in this life, by observing people around us and their mental condition, by observing our mental condition, we can clearly infer as to what's going to happen, the karmic consequences of people's actions. So people who really enjoy fighting, people who really enjoy aggression, anger, violence, and that's their form of entertainment, we can infer that when that person dies, birds of a feather come together. You will only take rebirth where your mental state takes you. In other words, it's just like it says in the Bible, you know, in the New Testament, you know, as ye sow, so shall you reap. That's karma. And there are many karmic references in the New Testament. Unfortunately, in Christianity, they've kind of overlooked that in terms of understanding. But at least Christ understood that the law of cause and effect is there. So we cannot experience an action we have not performed. So you being aggressive and violent, we can easily infer that you will be in an environment that is conducive to your mental state. If I plant potatoes, I shouldn't expect, you know, roses to grow. If I'm complimenting you, then there's a good chance that we're not going to get into an argument. But if I'm insulting you, I shouldn't expect a compliment from you. That's totally impractical. That's unrealistic. I'm constantly condescending and putting you down or whatever, but I expect you to be, you know, basically massaging my ego and saying, yes, yeah, you're very good, you're good, this one. Huh? That's unrealistic. In the long term, the karma that accumulates from that is quite negative and impractical. So without compassion, there's only suffering. Without compassion, there's only evil. So wisdom without compassion is evil. A lot of people say, oh, I want to study emptiness, the perfection of wisdom. That's my thing. And us in the West who have access to education and we have very sharp minds, a lot of people are in love with that concept of emptiness, wisdom, and that's it. But I hate to tell you this. Wisdom without compassion is evil. Because yes, you can be you're a very bright person working at Caltech or at MIT, and yet you can design a bomb that can destroy a whole city. So much for being a genius. Without compassion, why don't you use that genius faculty in order to feed people, clothe people, share your knowledge and wisdom? Not possible, because we have a miserly mind, no compassion, no bodhicitta. It's all about me, 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 me. And because of that, we can only find a lower state of existence. All of samsara, which is the cycle of birth and death that we live in, all of those different planes, from the formless realm to the hell realms, we can see in the psychological states in terms of where we live in. Do you want to see what the god realms live in? Or how the gods live? Go to Vaucluse. Go to Potts Point, where people are so rich, we don't need to interact with anybody else. I don't even have any concept. It's like JFK said when he was growing up, that's John Kennedy, the late president, when he said he was so rich and affluent that he didn't even know there was a depression on. What depression? Dude, we went through a depression in the 20s and 30s. People jumped out of windows. They couldn't find a job, worked. I don't know. What are you talking about? Have another martini, you know? That's the God realm. You have accumulated so much positive, not virtue, but positive karma, that now it has manifested in a material sense. That's wonderful. Good on you. And again, rejoicing. Fantastic. Wow. That's wonderful that you can do that. But the thing is, in the God realm, there is no chance or opportunity to practice Dharma or accumulate virtue to buy that ticket. Why? I can't. I've got another party to go to. You know, and I've got to get, you know, I don't know. I'm getting sick of Armani, you know. I'll think of something else, you know. It's too much, you know. And then the thing is, in the God realm, just like, or here in the human realm, just like in the God realm, when somebody begins to age, lose their physical appearance, you don't get invited to the parties as much anymore. People are looking after younger people, you know, somebody a little more famous, somebody more, you know, got that little bit of life, that little bit of spark, make me feel younger, you know. So it's the same thing in the God realms, where, sure, the God realms, you live for an extremely long time, extremely beautiful. And that's really why the Buddha himself emanates an aura. Because when the Buddha taught in the God of the 33, when he taught specifically for his mother who passed away and was born there, in order to stand out amongst the gods, the Buddha had to be more beautiful, more attractive, more luminous than them. Hence, he had to project this aura about himself, hence the golden appearance. Because if you're beautiful and attractive, you're not going to look at somebody, get away from me, you know? You have to be more attractive than them. And then you say, hello. And then I'll listen to you. First of all, you hook them because they're sexually attractive, and then they realize, oh, okay, you're teaching me the Dharma now. Okay, right. That's how it works. And that goes to show you the deluded state that we're in. But there's nothing wrong with that. Why? Because that's the way we've been brought up. That's our karma. So we shouldn't be punishing ourselves. Again, it's just understanding where we are. It's like that psychological game or experiment in Martin Place. This attractive woman, she does herself up like an old lady, and nobody wants to help her carry the baggage. She puts on a red miniskirt and high heels. Everybody wants to help her carry the bags through Martin Place. That's just the way it is. That's, you know. But the thing is, you shouldn't feel guilty about that. You shouldn't feel like, yeah, I've done that. I've said that. I've felt that, whatever it is. This is all the purification process. It has to come to the surface. You have to be honest with yourself. You don't have to say it to anybody, you have to be honest with yourself. And this, when you have a genuine teacher, this is what's going to happen. When you have a one-on-one relationship with the teacher, they're going to know, right? That's it. You do this, you do that, you do this, you do that. That's what's going to help you to purify your actions. If you resist, then you're basically stymieing your own progress. It's about you, not about anybody else. That's why it's wrong to be talking about, oh, I had this dream about the Dalai Lama last night and he gave me the winning lottery tickets. What? I think it's more like your ego. But you don't speak about things like that, because you're attracting negative influence, and also becomes competitive. So how come you dream about the Dalai Lama and I don't dream about the Dalai Lama? I don't like you. Again, I'm not rejoicing for your good fortune. So then now there's a combative situation here. In other words, you've just brought your worldly life into a spiritual environment. Leave that with the shoes. Don't bring it in here. Don't contaminate that environment. Because you're just going to make this a part of, you're going to make this environment just an extension of your living room or your office. No disrespect there, because your office is back there. So motivation is very, very important. And then when we see this, we have to realize that yes, we have got it wrong. We will always get it wrong. And what's the proof of that? Well, here we are. We're born in samsara. We're born in this particular place, which is the realm of desire. Desire for wealth. Desire for food. Desire for sex. And basically, that's the three aspects of human existence are in those three branches. Sex, money, and food. That's really what we've spent all our lives doing that. And time is running out. So, by understanding karma, we can clearly now see for the first time what we need to adopt and what we need to abandon. What is it that we need to abandon? We need to abandon suffering and the causes of suffering. What is it that we need to adopt? We need to adopt virtuous action in body, speech, and mind. So who do we know that actually has this virtue? Who is it? Not our family members, not anybody at work, anybody that you socialize with. All these people, as I mentioned before, they're only there helping us to ingrain the suffering that we're experiencing in samsara. They're only making us more at home in samsara. They're not actually allowing us to say, well, okay, this time next week we're going to be going on pilgrimages and we're going to be meditating, we're going to be getting rid of all this suffering, etc., etc. That's pretty rare to be involved with somebody in your family that thinks that way. Most of us, most of humanity does not fall into that category. Most of us, we're just taught that we have to get an education, get a job, get married, have children, and then, die. That's it. So no wonder we feel lost and confused, for most of us, because we know there is more to life than just that. Because animals have families, jobs, and make money. And then, of course, they just eat, have kids, So we do the same thing. So we're not using this full human potential. And the course we're reborn as an animal is not using your mental faculties. Because all we're doing is just eating, working, that's about it. We're not using our mind for any virtuous action whatsoever. So virtue is defined as any action in body, speech, or mind that is a cause for future enlightenment. That's what virtue is. Anything in body, speech, or mind. So suffering. What does it mean when we say suffering? What exactly does that mean? We know the gross forms of suffering. Somebody hits us, we receive a bruise, a cut, etc., etc. That's obvious. But that is a result of many, many forms of subtle subtle karma. So the action of somebody yelling at me or insulting me, that is a karmic action that is due to me insulting somebody else, either in this lifetime or previous lifetimes. As soon as somebody insults me, that action now is purified. I've actually paid back my debt to that person, as long as I don't retaliate. If I retaliate, insult that, well, it's on again. And so the cycle goes around and round and round. So what does it mean to suffer? So now we look at, in terms of the Four Noble Truths, in terms of the Buddha taught the first of the Four Noble Truths, which is suffering. He didn't teach the origin of suffering, which you think would be the first, but it's actually the second. So he said that everything is suffering, which is really to wake us up, as I've been just discussing, in terms of karma, in terms of what a little bit we've discussed. It's not possible to get into the full details, but you can, hopefully you can clearly see that we're not as virtuous and we're not as clean as we like ourselves to be. Even though, yes, we haven't killed anybody in this lifetime, we haven't done anything really that compares to some of the atrocious things that have happened. But nevertheless, that doesn't mean that we don't possess within our mental continuum the karma of actually killing someone. We have done that in previous lifetimes, many, many, many times, and have ordered other people to kill other people, just like Michael Corleone, etc., etc. Many, many, many lifetimes we've done these things. And so somebody who's really genuinely sharp of mind and begins to study the law of cause and effect, they will clearly see that, well, hang on a second, I'm not as saintly as I thought I was. I'm not as clean. I'm not as free from suffering as I thought I was. Because I still, within my mental continuum, have these negative actions that I have done that can ripen any time. Because I've hurt somebody, maybe something will happen tonight. The karmic cause of murdering any sentient being is that you will experience a short lifespan should you have the good fortune to reborn as a human. So, when we see children dying in the uterus, even some not even born, when we see children, why do the good die young? Why do the good die young? People who believe in God have a very difficult time comprehending that why would God take away such a young, innocent child? From a Buddhist point of view, yes, it is a tragedy that people have to die. But from a Buddhist point of view, again, we don't look at the appearance, we look at the consciousness. So somebody who died at the age of 10 or 5 or something like that, we can be pretty certain that in their previous life or a couple of lifetimes before, they were responsible for somebody's death or multiple deaths. There's no doubt about that. So what's the tragedy? That they died as a 5-year-old? Or the tragedy that they thought it was a good idea to kill some people so many years ago or so many lifetimes ago? The tragedy is that you are in samsara overall. That's the tragedy. So the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas look at us and say, you're in samsara. Wherever you are, high or low, you will experience suffering. Rich or poor, whether you're a king or you clean toilets for a living in terms of a social structure, you have the same potential to achieve enlightenment, and you have the same potential also to be reborn in a lower state of existence. So it's all suffering. It's pervasive. So there's the suffering of change, the suffering of suffering, and the all-pervading suffering, which is all of samsara. There is no place in samsara that you can run away to and say, here, this is my green little corner where I'll be safe and snug, and for the rest of my life, for all eternity, I will just rest in ever-loving peace. It doesn't work like that. Unfortunately, it's not that way. Because we can't run away from our karma, our karmic responsibilities. We have a karmic obligation. So everything is suffering. Cessation of suffering. Suffering, cause of suffering. But cause of suffering, this is the subtle point, and at this point, This is where, for those of you who know the life of the Buddha, where the Buddha achieved enlightenment, Bodhgaya, and then for 49 days just sat there because he said, this is too profound. Nobody's going to understand this. Huh? What? He's not going to do anything. He's not going to go out on the journey. He's not going to turn the wheel. He's not going to go to Sarnath. You know, that was his first. He's the Buddha, right? He knows everything. And he says, it ain't going to work. Nobody's going to understand this. It's just too profound. The cessation of suffering. To understand the cessation of suffering, the cause of suffering, beg pardon, is just too profound for people off the street to know. So then he was invoked by Brahma, the god of the gods, the god of the worldly gods. And he said, listen, you promised so many lifetimes ago, 3 eons ago, an eon is the time that a universe is born from a big bang, expands, contracts, it comes back together. 80 of those constitute a great eon. The Buddha took 3 of those great eons to achieve enlightenment through the sutric path. Okay? So Brahma is now speaking to the Buddha and saying, you promised all those eons ago that you're going to achieve enlightenment for all mother sentient beings. You've done it. You have to fulfill your obligation. No, I can't do it. It's too profound. In the Buddhist scriptures, this is echoed where Jetsun Kapa, the founder of the Gelugpa tradition, where he's writing the Lamrim Chenmo, which is what I'm discussing here now, which is the aspects of Lamrim. And when he was writing the chapter on emptiness, on profound view, he said, I'm not going to do this. I'm going to leave this out. Then Manjushri appeared to him and he said, you have to put this in, you know, you must do this. Jisukam said, no, it's too profound. Nobody will understand this. You have to do it. And he did put it in. So likewise with the Buddha, he was finally convinced that, yes, okay, I will have to turn the wheel of Dharma. But strangely enough, that the first person the Buddha decided to teach was actually dead. And so then he said, oh, okay, all right then. My disciple, the people that I hung around with, those 5 sadhus, you know, I'll go to Sana and turn the wheel. So why is it so profound? It's profound because now to find the origin of suffering, you really have to go inside. There really isn't a place to hide. At this point, we're talking about somebody who has developed renunciation and can clearly see that interacting with people with worldly concerns, gain, loss, pleasure, pain, fame, infamy, praise, and scorn, the 8 worldly concerns. When we are talking about people, when we're interacting with that, there is no freedom from that. There is only more continued suffering. So somebody develops renunciation, I renounce suffering, the cause of suffering, I renounce samsara and the causes therein. I'm looking within to free myself. That's where the actual spiritual journey starts. It's at that point. Very, very few people in the world pass through that door. Very, very few people pass that door, let alone knock on that door. You are very lucky because you are voluntarily trying to find that origin of suffering. The origin of suffering is self-cherishing mind that you might have heard His Holiness the Dalai Lama speak about and others. This illusory concept of somehow that we exist in a concrete, permanent form. It's a little bit counterintuitive because we can see that things exist concretely, so we think. That things will change or things don't change so quickly. And it takes a very brave person to stand and look up in the sky and say, you know, I don't think the sun is actually moving. I think we're moving around the sun. But all your senses are saying, the sun is actually moving. Because look, it's coming up and then it goes down. But yet, I don't feel anything else changing around me other than the sun actually transitioning. It's counterintuitive, isn't it? So it's the same thing here. It's all your fault that I'm suffering. It's the world, you know. It's the liberals. It's the Labour. It's the National Party, you know. It's Donald Trump. It's all his fault. No. It's you. It's us. We have the karma to reborn here. Therefore, we have an obligation. We have a responsibility. But we're not aware of it. Because everything around us is happening and we're preoccupied with that. This is attractive. That's repulsive. And everything else in between that. So everything becomes politics, as I mentioned before. We are preoccupied with politics, good and bad, evil and virtue. But where do you fit in? Well, no, I'm good. I'm always good. I've always been good and I will always, you know, be that way. That's wrong. So we have this self-cherishing mind. It's not the ego. The ego is a byproduct of this, what is perceived as an inherently existent I. This concept comes about through all our aggregates that we have and through the interaction of the consciousness with the body, with the environment, in a very, very brief introduction to it. So I have this concept, first of all, of myself, and myself likes this, likes that color, likes that person, doesn't like that person. Through that, now I'm creating karma. Through that karma, that now accumulates within my consciousness because now I've developed desire, anger, jealousy, hatred, pleasure, pain. But because I have a survival instinct in order to preserve this body, now I have to do other things as well. I have to get rid of competition, murder. I'm interested in that woman. I need to get rid of competition, you know, from her. My country is better than your country. And we can see that, for example, when the British were when they were anywhere in the world. Singapore, India, you know, the white Sahib. It's so good to be white, you know. Rule Britannia. And all that kind of stuff. It's all nonsense. It's nonsense. And then the gross delusion is seeing Indians, or in this example, Indians or people in Singapore, believing that, yeah, I've got to be white to be good in this world. That's a gross delusion, to be thinking that somehow being Westerner or white is the best thing to do, you know. So in that example, which is a historical example, lies the whole key to this self-cherishing mind, to thinking I'm better than somebody else. And even if I have to lie and pretend, I will do that in order to preserve my reputation, to preserve my wealth, to preserve my influence, power, political influence. I will need to get rid of anything or anybody that challenges me. So to counteract that, we need to develop compassion. That is the only antidote. As Arya Shantideva says in the Bodhisattva's Way of Life, you know, all the Buddhas of the past have searched what is the antidote for suffering, and that antidote is the enlightened mind. There is no other antidote to self-cherishing mind. So when somebody is compassionate, when they're willing to help others, we say, you're selfless. When we meditate on this so-called I, inherently existent I, this thing that we really believe really exists, on the actual emptiness of that, we say we meditate on the selflessness of the person. So, the synonym itself is representative of true existence. So we have conventional bodhicitta, which is compassion, and ultimate bodhicitta, which is emptiness. To be selfless nicely encapsulates both conventional bodhicitta and ultimate bodhicitta. So somebody's selfless. They're not thinking about themselves. That's why I said before, even if you pretend you're happy because somebody got married, it is a direct antidote to this self-cherishing mind. It is a direct antidote to your anger. That's how ingrained our concept of ourselves is. Through eons and eons and eons of lifetimes, we have developed and protected this concept of I, that even you experiment, and perhaps you've even come across that. We are so, how do you say, we are so protective of our concept of ourselves, that even if somebody looks at us, what are you looking at? Automatically, we become combative. What do you mean, what am I looking at? You know, so it goes to show you how much, how, it's not in terms of insecurity, it's really how, I'm not sure what the right word is. But anyway, it clearly shows to us how ingrained this whole concept of existence, us existing inherently, is. And if we go back a little bit now to the subject of death and impermanence, the ultimate betrayal that we will experience in this lifetime is when you realize that this body is letting us down. That's the ultimate betrayal. You think your husband left you, your wife left you, you think that your relatives let you down, or your brother or sister, or they've let you down. The ultimate betrayal that you will experience is that your body that we have protected for so long, pampered for so long, done all sorts of things, lied, cheated, murdered, gossiped, and all sorts of things to protect this form, it will let you down. It's a direct antidote. Death, impermanence, and contemplating on that is a direct antidote to pride, arrogance, self-grasping. So those people who say, Buddhism, it's so morbid. You guys think so much about death. And lighten up, man. Come on. It's spiritualism. Crystals. Get with it. Incense. But from a Buddhist point of view, we're saying, no, man. You're the one that's deluded. Crystals can't help you. Incense, you can smoke all the incense you want, if that's what you want to call it. You know, it's not going to get you anywhere. The real thing that's going to get you somewhere is to look at reality as it is. To change your mind. Why do you need to change your mind? Because your mind got you into this in the first place. So everything we do is escapism. It's an anesthetic. It's a diversion. It's numbing our senses. For example, recreational drugs. It says it in the word, doesn't it? Recreational drug. Why do you need to take drugs for the fun of it? To escape. To escape from what? It said during the Vietnam War, talking about another colonial power. Sorry about the politics. When the Americans were in Vietnam, that the rise of taking of heroin was on the rise. Not because they were close to the Golden Triangle and it was cheaper, but because the environment that they were in was a hellish environment. When those soldiers went back home to the States, all of them, a majority of them, did not continue to be drug addicts anymore. Why? Because they were at home. The hellish environment no longer existed. In other words, they were on drugs because they needed to desensitize themselves to what they were doing, experiencing, and seeing in Vietnam, in a war zone. Recreational drug. My mind, it's a little bit, for those of you who are Sherlock Holmes fans, Conan Doyle, you remember that Sherlock Holmes in the book took cocaine and morphine. Why? Because his mind was so quick and agile, he needed to anesthetize it in order to put himself in a tranquil state, not to be thinking so much. So even in fiction, which is closer to reality for most of us, there's truth in that. So why do we need to take all these drugs? Why do we have this concept of, you know, boredom, suffering, loneliness, etc., etc.? All that boils down to the self-cherishing, this concept believing that somehow we inherently exist. We are independent of this body. How do we know that we're independently of this? How do we know that we think we are independent of this body? Well, for example, You touched my arm. Wait a minute. Whoa, whoa, backtrack. You touched my arm. Who's my? That implies ownership. My leg, my eyes, my hair. My. Who is my? Well, Robert. Well, who is Robert? Robert is this person that you see. Robert has these kind of characteristics. Are you Robert? Are you Robert? Are you Robert? Who's Robert? Robert possessed these kind of characteristics, so we give a list. So Robert is a label. Likewise, this body is a label. Man's body. White man. They don't exist inherently. They are dependent upon other aspects. So for you to understand that I am Robert, I need to introduce myself and say, ah, that's it, that's Robert. We'll put a label on that. And likewise with everyone else. Tina, yeah, Ben, etc., etc. Yeah? These are labels. But you can change those labels. Maybe the labels fall off. You know, we adopt other personas. They don't exist inherently. That's the grand delusion. Because if I existed inherently, permanently, I wouldn't have to die. I would never age. And every time somebody sees me anywhere in the universe, they'd say, ah, that's Robert. But no, I'm subject to, this body's subject to change. My consciousness, because it has in it, because it is under the subject of delusion, it really believes that it exists inherently. So therefore, it's saying, this is who you are, this is who you will always be. You are immutable. But that's wrong. That's absolutely wrong. Honey, we're going to get married and we're going to love each other till the day we die. That's possible, but not exactly going to happen. Because we change. Circumstances change, people change, minds change, we grow. It's a process of individuation. Again, Jungian concept. Constantly growing. The mind, the consciousness does not age. The body does age and change. And of course, again, harking back to what we were saying before, the consciousness is the thing that will go on to the next lifetime. If I die with that kind of delusion, then there's a chance, then for sure it's guaranteed that again my consciousness will take on another form and will still believe that it exists inherently, now under a different label. So that in a nutshell is the origin of suffering. Now the cessation of suffering. Again, this is a concept now. Is it possible to achieve enlightenment? Is it possible to stop being jealous and angry at someone? No. If you have a vendetta against somebody, this person really, truly, 100%, really, I hate them. They really did this to me. They really did that to me. They really, really need to suffer. Wow, such negative action, such negative thoughts. We think like that too, in subtle ways, don't we? Because when we see somebody, my brother, he's never going to change. What? Huh. My ex-wife, forget it. She's never going to change. What? Etc., etc., etc. We think that these people are forever going to be that way. Just because we have experienced them one way, we think that everybody else has the karma to experience them that way as well. That's not true. That's not true.